film reviews first, as usual, on a Thursday evening. We're deep into the summer season. Cue a Marvel Universe blockbuster. The Fantastic Four, First Steps, reboots. Marvel have never done that before, have they? Reboots Marvel's iconic superhero team in a retro-futuristic world. That's what it's called. We'll find out what that means later on. Pedro Pascal is in there, Vanessa Kirby, and the film follows the team as they balance their heroic duties with, guess what, saving the world from a threat called Galactus. Bring Her Back is an Australian supernatural horror film. A young boy called Andy and his stepsister Piper are sent to live with a foster mother, all very fairy tale like, isn't it, after their father's death. Secrets abound, and as the children uncover a terrifying occult ritual tied to the foster mother's dead daughter. Cheery stuff. The siblings face gruesome horrors and psychological dread, as you would. Gazer is a thriller co-written by and starring Ariella Mastroianni. It follows Frankie Rhodes, a young mother with dyschronometria, a condition that distorts her perception of time. She's struggling to regain custody of her daughter and takes on a risky job from a mysterious woman. Never a good thing, as she will find out in that story. And then there's this, Dying, a German, what they're calling a comedy drama. Now, you thought your family was bad. Well, the Looney's family, if that's how we say their name, the wife, Lissy, is dealing with her husband's dementia and her own terminal illness. The son is a conductor. He's working on a composition called Dying, and he's dealing with sudden fatherhood. And the daughter in the family is an alcoholic in the throes of a toxic affair. Suddenly, your family is the nicest family in the world. Those are our four films. Declan Burke and Tara Brady are with me in studio. There's only one place to start, really, isn't there? With the big one, the Fantastic Four. Retro-futuristic. This is really... Now, Marvel do this a lot. They want to have their cake and eat it. So they want to be futuristic, but they also want to be retro. Explain, Declan.
Well, if anyone out there has ever seen an episode of the Jetsons cartoon, they will know exactly what retro futuristic is. So we're back in what looks like the 60s. I mean, it's the year Earth 828, I believe, is how it's introduced. Now, that might make sense to Marvel fans, but for me, it's the 1960s. It's quite a clunky and analog world. The tech is very clunky. The new suits that they've been designing for themselves are somewhat less streamlined, shall we say, than the current Vogue, but would have been considered quite funky
back in the 1960s.
In the 1960s.
Or in 828 on Earth.
Exactly that.
They will be funky again.
So they have gone for this milieu which kind of pushes the Fantastic Four back, you know, 50 years and so forth. And I think it's because the Fantastic Four themselves as a group, as an idea, are much more simplistic, much more suited to that era, to that time, when superheroes were very, you know, binary. It was good versus evil. Donald Clark, actually, yesterday in the Irish Times, he was writing that their superpower is nostalgia, which is possibly a tiny bit unfair, but actually, you know, it's a very good point.
And the other side about this is, I mean, this is a family affair. It really is, because the Pedro Pascal character is married to the Vanessa Kirby character, whose brother is... the other fella. And Patrick Pascal's best friend is the Thing, who's a big hairy... Well, he's not a hairy big scaly creature.
I mean, so we end up like seeing... Because this is, I think, the fourth Fantastic Four film, they're determined to not go over and make it an origin story again.
And yet instead
you end up with about half an hour of prologue, which is in fact an origin story. And you're looking at the four of them going off into space and going, this is the most nepotistic space mission of all time. So that's kind of the big idea. Yeah. The big idea is that we're not going to do this. We're going to do something else. But we have then this like very kitschy 60s aesthetic, which is quite fun. And then the film kind of takes this sort of leap and ends up being this sort of adjacent to Sophie's Choice plot.
Oh.
So we have a scene where, for example, when Sue Storm, played by Vanessa Kirby, is giving birth in space and her trousers go flying off. I'm not a theoretical physicist, but my son actually is. And I'm told reliably that doesn't happen.
And does the baby? What happens to the baby?
That's a more natural birth.
So this happens, but you can't really really have that in a movie where then it becomes this big serious choice between shall we save the earth or will we give up the
baby?
Yeah, well, the trousers is a thing, but so they have this, and they also have this kind of some of the marriage between Sue Storm and Pedro Pascal, who I think is very miscast in the role because he just doesn't have that sort of chiseled Marvel 60s. He needs to have like a kind of George Clooney chin or something. He needs to have that kind of 60s.
They're very hard to get.
Yeah,
and George Clooney chin.
But that doesn't. I mean, so there are times when I'm looking at that marriage and I'm thinking, is this like an Ingmar Bergman film or something? Okay. I mean, they really shouldn't be together.
All right. I suppose if you want the aesthetic, I was looking at the trailer for today. I mean, it's Austin Powers in many ways, isn't it? And the voiceover for the trailer has all of that stuff in it. But it isn't an origin story. They're busy telling us that. Then they call it First Steps. And here is one of those from the opening section that you were talking about there, Tara. And we'll have Pedro Pascal as Mr. Fantastic. And he's explaining here, you'll hear the TV announcer voice, that kind of 1960s style in there as well. You'll also hear The Thing, who has the catchphrase, clobbering time. It's clobbering time. It's played by Eben Moss Bacharach. And Julia Garner then, as Silver Surfer, comes in saying, stop the lights, lads. There's a bit of a problem on Earth 828.
Obviously, while we were in space, due to errors on my part, we encountered a cosmic storm that altered our DNA. We came back with anomalies.
They returned with superpowers. They became our protectors.
It's clobbering time!
I herald his beginning. I herald your end. I herald. Galactus.
Well, I suppose if you're going to be retro-futuristic, you can herald both the beginning and the end at the same time, as Julia Garner did there in that clip from the Fantastic Four, First Steps. I think, looking across at you, Declan Burke, you had a bit of fun with this and the 1960s retro feel.
I did, and I mean, the 1960s aspect is very enjoyable, certainly, but my general expectations and tolerance for superhero movies is quite low these days, Sean. So I went in, it was very simple, it was very direct. They have gone for something that's not as complex. You know, we say Batman has many shades of grey about him and so forth. Mm. What they've gone for is a younger audience, I think, with this. They're acknowledging that the usual superhero fan is maybe a bit older, but they've gone for a younger, more linear kind of storytelling. It's clean lines. I think there's a nice collective chemistry between the four. They're like a genuine family.
Pedro Pascal, Vanessa Kirby.
Bishop and
Joseph Quinn is the other one.
And there's friction and so forth. The kind of way families tend to behave. Look, it's a superhero movie, so maybe our expectations shouldn't be too high. But I did have fun with it.
And most important question for the superhero movies, how long is it now? Does it overstay its welcome?
It is under 2 hours. So, like, I mean, I think that's, why Declan did have fun.
Is it under an hour and a half?
No, it is not, unfortunately, under an hour and a half. So, no, it's not that much fun.
Always a good guideline for a snappy film.
I will also say the Silver Surfer character, who's played by Julia Garner, which the gender casting has caused much upset amongst the boys in the fanhood. She's one of the best things that happened to superhero genre in the last 10 years. I think it's a terrific character. She does it really, really well.
So you enjoyed this?
I did. I had a lot of fun.
Stars?
Yeah, it's goofy, it's ridiculous, it's preposterous, but it is fun. It's 4 stars for me.
Despite the presence of Ingmar Bergman and a few other major filmmakers, I didn't find it goofy enough.
I think it starts that and it doesn't lean enough into that, and I want the full Flash Gordon. That's what I want. Is it too much to ask for?
If they can give it to us for 1.5 minutes of the trailer, which I thought, that looks kind of like a bit of fun, but you need to be giving that to us for the full 2 hours. Yeah, we need to be getting that.
Exactly.
Okay, so 2.5. And for the Fantastic Four, First Steps. Let's go to Bring Her Back. You've seen this one, Tara.
Yeah.
We're in Australia, in horror territory. In fact, look, it's an orphan sister, a brother and stepsister, mm-hmm. in fact, who are then taken in by foster mother, who really is a kind of, it's the evil stepmother. We're in fable, in fairy tale land here, aren't we, in some ways?
Yeah, so this is from Danny and Michael Philippou, who are the Australian directors. So there's a lot of attention on this film.
And they've done that kind of fable-y supernatural thing before.
Their first film, Talk to Me, was a kind of variation on the old Monkey's Paw myth, and it was really, really, it was very striking. But it leaned into a thing which is really common with the trope that people like to call elevated or arthouse horror, which is this idea that grief is the real horror, or like mourning is the real horror. And this sort of starts out a little bit like that, because we start out with these siblings that lose their father in the opening scene, and then are sent off to live with Sally Hawkins, and and they're sent out into the middle of nowhere as well.
Yeah.
And there really is a lot of Hansel and Gretel then.
Yeah.
There. And
so Sally Hawkins is not Mrs. Brown from Paddington here.
No, she most certainly. And I think it's a really brilliant piece of casting, because we always expect Sally Hawkins to be nice.
Mrs. Brown.
And, you know, we always expect her to be a person who's very understanding and consoling. And she's really not that person here. And also, I think there's a couple of really clever things as well. With Sarah Wong's character, because she's visually impaired,
it gives the
kind of new foster mother opportunities to really gaslight between the siblings and come between them. So it's a really good setup, and it starts out really well.
Can we listen to a clip just because this is from reasonably early on, I would guess. It's where they meet. Andy and Piper, Billy Barrett and Sarah Wong, as you mentioned there, meet the foster mother, Laura, played by Sally Hawkins.
Is this for Piper?
Oh, no. My daughter's blind.
Oh, is she here?
No, she's passed.
Sorry.
Well, that's all right, you didn't know. It's not your fault.
How'd she die?
Piper.
She's okay. She drowned.
Does she have a backyard?
It's pretty convenient. Oh, she does have a backyard. Do you want to see?
Oh, if you're going outside, don't let the cat out.
Baba. Don't wait here.
Just listening to it. So that's the moment when Sarah Wong and Billy Barrett, as the brother and stepsister, meet the Sally Hawkins character. And she's outside and was asking us, as we were listening to that, Tara Brady, where do we go when we go outside? Because obviously the soundscape changed there, and it sounded like a kind of a menagerie.
It's really interesting, because it sets things up around the house. We realise that there's some kind of circle around the house very quickly, and there's also a cat wandering around, and we do start to worry about what's happening to the cat, and there's also these mysterious like videotapes that we see Sally Hawkins watching that seem to be some kind of ritualistic horror, and we see those right at the start of the film. So it layers this kind of mythology, but we're not entirely sure how to disentangle them. And even at the end of the film, I wasn't quite sure how everything kind of piled on top of each other.
And was that a problem? You know,
I think it is. I don't think it's quite clear of its narrative. I think there are really, really gruesome pieces of horror, like body horror.
And these are children, effectively.
It is properly revolting. What it lacks, though, is that it definitely doesn't have the pathos or emotional depth of the previous film. And it also, I think, it doesn't have something like a jump scare. And I know it's lazy, a jump scare, jump out of your seat.
But you did have another moment. We don't want to say too much or give too much away. A kitchen utensil.
Yeah,
being used in ways that it perhaps has never been used before.
It's not recommended, and they probably had ads in the 1970s telling you not to use the kitchen utensil in this way. But it's that in itself is kind of indicative of what's a little bit wrong here, is that like you get long lingering shots that are really, really tough
too
to watch,
and
quite bruising to watch. But again, you don't have that kind of, and you do need that in a horror movie. You do need a little fun thing where you're jumping out of your skin, and this film doesn't have.
All right,
that.
So kind of work that sounds like for Bring Her Back stars.
Three
from Tara for Bring Her Back. Let's move on to Gazer. And the word gazer is kind of misleading here, but it explains something about the title or the main character here, Frankie, played by the co-writer and star of the show, Ariella Mastroianni.
Yeah, so Frankie Rhodes is the main character, and she's at the heart of what we quickly realise is it's kind of a neo-noir or a homage to noir. And she's always constantly watching. And she's observing. And that's, of course, where the title comes from. She is the gazer at the heart of this. And the reason for that is, as you mentioned in the intro, she suffers from dyschronometria, which means she can't perceive the passage of time conventionally.
Is this a real condition?
It is a real condition. She has to create markers for herself. So she will make a cassette that's 26 minutes long because that's the length of her bus trip
to get home, to
work and so forth. But what... not being able to understand time in the conventional way means is that she's much more observant of the world around her, both of people and events and so forth. And that is really what kind of stumbles her into the plot, because she sees a character called Paige. It's an abusive scenario, and suddenly she feels this empathy with that character.
There's this character that we meet that we think is called, who's referred to as being Paige, played by Renée Gagnier, and she's... Let's listen to the scene between the two of them, Tara, and I'll come to you then. This is the initial meeting, and it's a little bit creepy or awkward. I think certainly the discussion between the two of them.
You know, I think we might be able to help each other out.
What do you mean?
You need money. I need to disappear. I can give you a couple grand if you help me.
Doing what?
Try this, it's good.
No, I'm good.
Can you drive?
I mean, I shut in with my condition.
Okay, but can you?
What do you need me to do?
Just go to my apartment, get my keys, and then drop off my car somewhere remote.
And what about your brother? I don't want any trouble or any...
It won't be an issue, okay? He doesn't know you. He doesn't know what you look like.
You can get me $2,000?
I can get you $3,000.
Not bad for a wee bit of driving. Think about it myself. Renée Gagnier is the proposer of the $3,000 job there. Ariella Mastroianni, the character who has this difficulty with time. And we have seen that Renée Gagnier, or at least we think we have seen that Renée Gagnier character being physically abused in a rear window type of way earlier in the film.
Yeah, I mean, she's a classic femme fatale character in some ways. I mean, she could be out of a Marlowe mystery or any of those. She's like this person who comes in with this object, like a damsel in distress. She needs assistance, and she's also offering money. So it seems like a no-brainer. Yeah. But of course, not everything is as it seems. And the car turns up, and there's a dead body in it, and suddenly everything is unraveling for the heroine.
Yeah, I started watching this afternoon, but I couldn't get to watch, and I will go home and watch the rest of it later on. But one of the things that struck me, I wondered about this chronometria situation. How reliable is, first of all, the Mastroianni character in everything she's telling us, and how reliable are the filmmakers as well in that? Is time all over the gaff in this? Am I asking the wrong question? Should I just watch and find out?
The questions you're asking actually kind of sum up a lot of the appeal of this film to people, and particularly those who are steeped in noir. Now, the film is told in a pretty linear fashion. Okay. You don't have to worry too much about that. But Frankie's ability to decipher her surroundings and understand what's going on is crucial to the plot, as you're suggesting there. So in the classic detective stories, it's not that the detective is, you know, not just baffled as to the client's motives or the villain's motives, so forth. They're also exploring the culture as they go along, and they're trying to tell us something about the world they find themselves in.
And we're kind of, even though we're in inverted commas, contemporary New York, the look of it is not contemporary New York. It's shot in a very pretty, in 16...
Yeah. It's shot in 16 mil, and it's New Jersey, but it's also, it's the seediest kind of New Jersey streets, and it's that kind of very, like, it's very kind of poverty stricken in a way that you don't often see in American cinema, even in American independent cinema. And that's kind of, that aesthetic is woven in, and it's very baked into the film, and it's very clearly meant to evoke a certain kind of, a certain period of noirish 70s, kind of like Brian De Palma's Blowout or Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation. There's a real 70s kind of feel around it.
And Mastroianni also gives us a fair bit of voiceover in it, which is a classic noir thing as well. I'll stick with you for a second, Harry. I've only watched a small amount of it at this point in time, but it's slow.
Is
that okay?
I didn't mind. I actually find it has its own rhythm, particularly as it becomes kind of part of the story where she loses time.
Yeah.
So she'll suddenly be doing something and then realize, oh, actually, my tape ran out, and that actually it becomes part of the story.
Did it work for you, Tara?
Yeah, no, very much so. Like, I mean, to me, it's an easy 4 stars. Like, that was a really, really good, really strong debut, and I think Arielle Mastro is just superb in it. Like, she's just.
Did we say who directed? Ryan J. Sloan, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's his debut.
Yes. Yeah.
And he co-wrote it with Mastroianni.
So
a very solid 4 from you. Declan, did it work overall? You're the big fan of certainly noir on the page.
Ticked an awful lot of boxes for me, and particularly as Tara's suggesting, because it's this homage to a particularly 1970s noir, very seedy. The mean streets of New Jersey are very, very well done. It is a slow burner, as you're suggesting, but that is very much of that type of film.
Yeah.
And if you're buying into it, you'll really enjoy it. 4 stars from me.
Be patient, Sean. That's what you're telling me. All right, that is Gazer. Finally then, Dying. I mentioned this one. The Loonies, you know, I would say nothing more other than that. It does sound like the most dysfunctional family in the world. It's billed as a comedy drama where you have a mother with a terminal illness, a father who has dementia, a son who can't deal with fatherhood and is dealing with a piece called dying, and both his parents are in the situation that they're in, and then the daughter who's in the toxic relationship and she's an alcoholic. It doesn't strike me as there's much comedy in this drama.
No. When they say black comedy, they really mean black.
Black German comedy is probably even blacker than the usual.
I mean, there's parts of the film that will be familiar to you if you watch a lot of like big films in recent years. Certainly the like, it's divided into sections. And the section with the parents and about elder care is very reminiscent of, say, Gaspar Noé's Vortex, or Michael Haneke's Amour. So again, big, heavy hitting films, and you know,
is it in that category in terms of its how it realizes these themes?
Definitely.
It
definitely gets there. It has scenes. There's also because the main character is a conductor. There's a lot of overlap with Tar. And then finally we get something that's quite like Almodovar's Room Next Door, like a euthanasia situation towards the end. So there's a lot going on in here. It's very, very heavy. So, but weirdly,
this is a three-hour, five-chapter movie.
It's 3 hours, and it's a lot. But like, there are definitely comic moments, but they're quite gruesome. Certainly, there's a dental scene that makes you glad you're not in the dental chair. So that's because
there's a lot of bodily fluids, a lot of blood involved. When a tooth is extracted, there's a lot of blood.
Yes,
you don't normally get a kiss afterwards.
I'm not giving too much away there, am I? No, that's a scene. There's a lot of other bodily fluids which are even less pleasant. It's quite full on. So even though it's 3 hours long, you are like watching it going, well, I'm not bored. I'll say that. I'm not bored. But I do think it's a bit of a stretch calling it even a black comedy. I think it's heavy going.
It's a drama.
I think part of the thing is that the main character is this sort of blank slate who wanders sort of aimlessly through all this.
How well would we know the actors here?
I don't think you'd really know them from too much. They're well known in German, don't have a lot of big crossover hits. I would say in international terms. This went down very well at Berlin when it played there, and it's obviously a thing. I think it does suffer a little bit that it overlaps with so many kind of like very big heavy hit and art house films in recent years.
But if you're looking
it's his own thing.
A full art house meal.
Oh, it is. It's
five chapters, three hours.
It's double art house first thing Monday morning. That's what it is. Yeah.
It's the first thing Monday morning.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're recommending Stars?
Yeah. No, I think it's four, but like obviously don't go if you're looking for an actual comedy.
Not a comedy.
Not an actual comedy.
Okay. This is not a comedy. Dang is the title of that film. And Tara and Declan speaking to us about Gazer, about The Fantastic Four, and about Bring Her Back, the four films that Tara Brady and Declan Burke reviewed for us on this Thursday evening. The writer Mary O'Donnell has 8 poetry collections, 4 novels, and now 3 short story collections to her name. In Walking Ghosts, her latest short story collection, she explores characters navigating a society in flux, sun-drenched beaches to the streets of Ireland. They face lockdown anxieties, urban challenges, moments of profound human connection, and moments, I would say, of profound human isolation. Lots of these characters as well. Delighted that Mary O'Donnell is with me in studio this evening. And as I said to you coming in, Mary, you're the busiest writer in Ireland. I know you answered, that's what writers do, we write. But you seem to, it's across all genres in many ways, and you seem to never stop.
Oh, I don't know. It's not really true. I think if you write in 3 genres, it's going to look probably as if you're constantly producing. Mm. But believe me, Sean, I have massive gaps when nothing is happening. And then maybe there's a happy collision and you have 2 or 3 books coming out fairly close to one another.
Yeah, I think that's
just what happens. You know?
That's the current scenario, isn't it? I have a
book of poems coming out next year with Wake Forest University Press.
And a novel that, if not ready, is it kind of nearly there?
The good news is that this has been a great week for me because I've just been signed up with a very exciting British publisher. And more anon. No, of that's
which,
all I got.
Of which more anon. Okay. Teaser trailer there from Mary O'Donnell. Now, Walking Ghosts is enough to be talking about without any of the other stuff at any rate. And that title kind of, it struck me that it describes nearly all of the characters in this book in many ways. They're in this in-between spot where something in the past is haunting them, or they're trying to get away, they're trying to change where they are in their lives, they're trying to move forward in some kind of way. They are lonely individuals for the most part.
Yeah, they probably are, but no more or less than the rest of us, I think. What I'm interested in is the many ghostly selves that we have as we negotiate life, our very ordinary lives a lot of the time. There's this other part that I think I just want to lift out in these characters. I want to lift them up and say to the reader, please look at this man. Mm. His wife has just left him because she's fallen in love with another woman and he's trying to reinvent himself, you know. Or, you know, please look at this woman who is caring for her very elderly mother and totally stressed despite appearances. Mm. And she finds a dead body, not her mother's, but a dead body. So what you want to do is to elevate the outwardly ordinariness about our lives, because we're all extraordinary. You know, I think when I was a child, I liked to listen to the stories that other girls told at school. This is in primary school.
Oh, the writer was alive and well.
And I liked to tell stories, you know.
Yeah.
And in the St. Louis in Monaghan, we did this sometimes for just sheer entertainment. But I think that oral pattern is maybe, you know, I know it's a cliche, but I think it's true also in Ireland. We told stories. And I still love stories.
Well, you know, there's a character. There are several writers in the book. It has to be said, characters across it. And in Peach Jam, I think it's one of the, it is the writer in Peach Jam, and this is a woman who's debating with herself whether she'll get in contact with a man
with an old lover.
Kind of the first love type of thing.
Yes.
But she says at some point along the way, I think it's her. I'm pretty certain it's her. there were secrets everywhere to be uncovered. That's what make writers, that's what writers know. So where are you uncovering those secrets? Where are you finding them? Do you find them every day, everywhere you look?
You find them everywhere. I mean, obviously you invent plenty of them as well. But I know from, I suppose I do listen closely to people I meet. They're not necessarily friends, but I am genuinely interested in the things people say. And you realise, gosh, they have this whole other life.
Mm.
And I think this is the wonder of, it is a wonderful thing that in some ways it can leave us feeling very isolated if we think there's no one else to connect with about this, whatever it is. But in another way, it does create connections as well when you realise that actually everybody is carrying this magical trove. Not all of it is bright, some of it is quite dark, but it's still there. And, you know, I try to place it, well, I don't try consciously, but it ends up in some of the stories probably being placed against a background in which certain social change is happening, sometimes of a distressing nature. Like, say, for the example, the couple on a beach in one of the Canary Islands. And I've almost forgotten the name of the actual story. But anyway, it's a couple on holidays. And towards the end of their holiday, one of them is a theatre nurse. Her partner is a resting actor. And they've met these Russians who try to fool them.
Yeah.
But at the end of it,
this is all we can do. All we can do is.
And the end of that story is based on an item that I did hear about a group of Malians who were swept up on one of those islands some years ago, while all the people were lying on the beach sunning themselves. And these people just were swept in on a raft, a broken raft. And so I suppose I kind of, through my fiction, I don't intend to, but I think it is asking me to take responsibility in some way. And if anyone happens to read it and feels the same, I think that's great. I'm not proselytizing or preaching, but I am very, very interested in how things play out.
And that hearing of that real life event, that's not exactly what happens here, or it's not exactly what happened. You know, it's not exactly the same people
absolutely
who are on the
not
beach. So you do fictionalize it and it becomes something else, I'm sure. And therefore,
it's just an inspiration, really.
It just gets you started. I have to say there was one particular story that really stopped me in my tracks, because it caught me unawares a little bit further into. You probably know which one I'm heading to.
I don't.
Like Queens, not Criminals. Because the narrator, you're listening to the narrator and she's talking about the fact that she has to travel to England. Do you need to take a drink of the water there?
No, I'm
okay.
She's
talking about the fact that she has to travel to England and she's travelling for an abortion to England. And it's only as the story goes on, we find out more about her, what period of time we're in and what period of her life that she's in. That's what surprised me.
Yeah, that story was written in the early 90s. And so it's set during a time when it was actually a criminal offence to travel to England to have a termination. And in fact, in the interim, and most recently, I published an essay about that in Banshee. Because I think it is a shocking and a terrible thing for any woman to have had to leave their own country to have an early termination. And that is what I wanted to write about. In that story, the protagonist is speaking to the spirit of the unborn, aborted child.
She's
addressing the child that she feels still with her for a while afterwards.
And this is a woman not in the situation that we would, in the cliched world, associate with somebody travelling to England in the 1970s to get an abortion.
No, she's a woman in her 40s who has a family already. We're not told why this is happening, because it is all about the question of leaving Dublin on an early morning flight. All the businessmen are on the plane reading their Financial Timeses, tucking into their nice breakfasts, and she's heading off to go to a clinic. And that's what it's about. It's a beautiful early autumn day. The English gardens are in bloom. And so all this is happening. And it also traces what the dilemma she goes through on the day before she actually has the termination.
Yeah. And that fact that she is addressing the soul of the unborn child. That's what she's doing. I mean, emotionally, I found that quite, very, very difficult to read, or certainly very moving to read. Does that hit you when you're writing it? I mean, the moment, I suppose, the point at which you as a writer thought, this is who she's talking to, or the point at which you decided that, is there an emotional kick in that, or are you removed from that emotional element?
When I wrote that story, I mean, obviously, quite clearly, it's based on my own experience. When I wrote it, I think it came very naturally. It was just something I wanted to do. It didn't come out in a big emotional splurge, because no matter what story you write, you have to pull back and be very cold about it. And I think especially the more powerful the subject, which was what I needed to do then.
But sharing that, as you have done with us just now here on air, and sharing that in a book, that's a whole different thing from writing it and saying, now I've written that and I've expressed something on the page that is for me and that unborn child. That can't have been easy to do.
I don't recall it as being difficult, to be honest. And, you know, no matter what I write, I really don't care, actually. I don't care, because what I'm doing, I am offering something. You can take it or leave it. The way I take or leave the things I read, some things I regard as really precious and they change my life, you know, and then others I just toss them aside. So that is entirely within a reader's control.
Yeah, and I suppose that's part of the contract, isn't it?
Yes.
Here's the bit of writing. You're the reader. Off you go and do with it what you want. I suppose that's what you do when you publish a book, be it essays, be it stories like this, be it poetry or be it a novel. That's what you set out. Spain. Now, you mentioned that in the story, All We Can Do Is, we're in the Canaries, but Spain and that kind of neck of the woods features a lot, and that is hardly surprising. There's one particular story I'm thinking of now. Will I be able to get the name of it? The one with the tarot card reading.
Yeah,
Luck is the title. Yes.
Well, I suppose my Martin and Anna, my daughter and I, we used to spend a lot of time in Spain when she was at school, because she was learning Spanish. So off we trotted to Spain quite dutifully, you know, but loved it. And so you do get a chance to observe everything that's going on in the side streets and the tarot readers. And that whole question of destiny and luck is of great interest to me. I read a short story by R.K. Narayan, the Indian writer, many years ago, called An Astrologer's Day. And that sort of inspired this story about a man who may or may not be, you know, above board and what his fate will be.
Yeah.
You may have noticed that five of the stories in the book are the protagonist is male.
Yes.
So I'm interested in, loosely we'll call it masculinities, I suppose. But I think what is the fate of men, and the way they live their lives is, and how they must live their lives sometimes, is of great interest, equal to the interest we have in female lives.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the other way around for a male writer. I guess the interest must be there in the different genders rather as well. But in this story, I was struck. It's only a tiny little detail, but it just struck me for some reason. Because Peach Jam, the story that we spoke about, where the woman is debating whether to get in contact with an old lover or not, her daughter is aware of this old lover. Her husband is aware of this old lover. You know, this the first love. They've all spoken about it. And here we are in Luck. And she goes in to get her tarot cards read, does this particular woman, who again is dealing with a little bit of a hurt from the past that a man has dealt upon her. And she goes in to get her tarot card read, and her daughter is with her.
Yes.
I don't know why that particular detail strikes me, but there was something, and the daughter's there on the phone kind of going, yeah, come on, just get it done, Mum, will you?
Yeah, I suppose some of these are, they're probably more liberal, modern types, perhaps. I'm not really sure, you know, and kids will go along with a lot of things, provided they know they're loved, you know, and I mean, in the end, the focus swings from that woman back to your man, who in fact has a very lucky outcome to his life, despite all. I mean, he's a complete chancer,
Well, he's a tarot card reader.
Yeah.
But I do, I put it to you, Mary O'Donnell.
Yes.
That in the, in
don't
the,
put it to me too much.
In the copy I got, I wish, now for those at home who are watching, in the midst of my copy was a tarot card. And now at the back of the tarot card just tells me a little bit about Mary O'Donnell, the award-winning writer, novelist, short story writer and poet, and a little bit of your biog. Did you choose different ones for, or did you specifically choose? You'll have to explain to me. And
I chose strength.
Strength. So and this is tarot card number 8. And yes. what is the character called?
Well, she's strength. She represents strength.
Yeah, and she's beside a lion there.
She has a lion there. Mm. And so fortitude, strength. What we need, we all need to get through, Sean, at any time, you know. And I thought it was a clever idea on my publisher's part, actually, to use the biog that way.
Well, given there you go. I was struck by it.
Yeah.
Because suddenly I read the back of it. Now, I would have read that anyway somewhere. But I read the back of it possibly in a way I wouldn't have read it had it not been on the tarot, on the tarot card. And of course, I thought, oh, that's great strength. There's a bit of strength. Strength for me as well. Are you a believer in tarot cards?
I would throw the tarot every so often myself, just for myself. It's a way into the subconscious, perhaps. I mean, I wouldn't inflict it on anybody else. Mm. It's just part of my own ways of occasional divination. And so I'll try anything, Sean. Probably.
So and what does that do? Do you believe what you read? Do you try to just interpret it as some kind of a guidance? What is it?
Yeah, it makes you think what may be going on in your in yourself at the time. At times when you need it. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time doing it.
Not all day, every
occasionally,
day.
Occasionally. If you want clarity on something, but it's really more an amusement. But sometimes it does throw light.
I mentioned that there are lots of characters in various situations at moments of change in their lives. And I was struck by the story "I'm So Lucky." This is about a transgender woman. Tell us a little bit about that story and why you wanted to write about that particular aspect of life.
Well, you know, many years ago, I met the delightful Dr. Lydia Foy in a workshop in Athy. And this was before she had got the legislation had come through that acknowledged her as a woman. And we were walking down the street together after an event, and a couple of young fellows came up against us, and one of them just said, "How are you, Lydia?" in a really slimy way that was just, and I just thought, how does she put up with this?
Yeah.
And that was the background to the story. What transgender people have to put up with.
And there is
just not fair.
And the transgender character here has to put up with a certain amount of that type of behaviour. But she
from
also
his landlady, yes.
But there's a beautiful moment when the pizza guy delivers the pizza, hands it to her and says, "Thanks very much, Mrs." and walks out.
Yeah, he gets it.
Says that's right. Listen, I don't know what's coming next. The poetry collection and the as yet unrevealed publisher of the new novel. I hope that we get a chance to talk about that when the time comes. Mary O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Mary talking to us about her latest collection, Walking Ghosts, which is published by Mercier. Musician, writer, ethnomusicologist Fintan Valley is known for his decades-long work documenting Irish traditional music. In his new book, he turns his attention to one of the genre's most misunderstood instruments, the Bowron. Beating Time, Cultural History of the Bowron, challenges long-held assumptions about the drum's ancient origins, tracing instead a complex evolution shaped by rural life, imported entertainment, cultural reinvention. And I'm delighted to have Fintan Valley sitting in front of me this evening, because I have to say, Fintan, I said it in the menu at the very top of the programme tonight. So how old do you think the Bowron is? Do you think it's a century old? Do you think it's several century old? Do you think it might even be a millennium old? None of the above are correct.
No. But there's no drum in Irish cultural history. If you read, I've gone through all the manuscripts, not cover to cover, there's nothing there. There's no drum. Our musical history is melodic. Purely melodic, as is the history of music in Northern Europe in general.
Mm.
We had no drums. We got drums from Islam during the Crusades. The British Army, French armies, they took on drums and they came into music from the armies. The first drums in Ireland came in with the British in 1599. And we stole some of them, of course. But
and we're in 1599. We're still a long way off the Bowron. But let's hold off on giving that piece of information out just for a moment yet. Because the word Bowron and the idea of the Bowron certainly did exist within Ireland, but not as a musical instrument. Yeah. It was a farm implement.
Well, it was an implement that was used for farming, for winnowing. It was also used in houses.
So this is separating the chaff from
Exactly, tossing the grain on the air to get rid of the chaff on a windy day. But also we used in houses as just a utensil, like a basket or a basin. You put the spuds out on the table in a boron, I think is the correct pronunciation of it, but that's another matter. But it was just a utensil, and it goes right back in history. The earliest mention of the word is in a manuscript from around 1550. It just refers to the fact that if you hit it, you get a kind of a resonant sound. But it was fairly simply made. But every house, it was like a subsistence. A device that it didn't cost anything to make. All you had to have was a dead goat or a sheep or something.
Yeah, you stretched.
And the folklore stories are full of mentions of the Bowron all over the country, but it's always a utensil.
Yeah, never, well, not used as a drumming.
It was improvised as a drum occasionally from maybe 1820 or so, but that was after tambourines had come into the country with commercial music.
Yeah, because the tambourine and the tambourin, I suppose, in French, and the baroque dance, that existed certainly in terms of baroque music, and which is kind of a courtly version of folk music, if you like, in many ways. So the tambourine, was that here as a musical instrument? Because what's striking in the book is you have illustrations from throughout history, you have descriptions from throughout history, and it is extraordinary when you say, no, those soldiers in that particular, when they're Celtic or when they're Irish soldiers, no, there isn't a drum to be seen.
We had pipers who were very easily shot, but mowed down. There's a picture of a dead piper in one of John Derrick's paintings from 1580s in the same picture, which there was an English drum. But the tambourine came in with commercial music in the middle 1700s. So you can see advertisements in all the presses for shows involving tambourines. But the big influx was with black and white minstrel shows. It sounds appalling by today's standards in the 1840s. And they toured the world from America.
This probably did involve, to a large extent, blacking up by various people involved.
A lot of whom were Irish. Mick Maloney has identified a lot of them as being Irish and good musicians, all of them. But they were touring, they toured the world, and their instruments were banjo, bones, a tambourine, and concertina or early accordion. So like those are four instruments which people like to believe these are like really old.
Yeah.
Long history in Irish music, but you know, these things, it's just part of popular music. But like, in other words, tambourines came into the original tambourines were in the Middle East, always played by women and always connected with religious ceremonies, but not at all in Ireland.
And the tambourine in various cultures didn't necessarily have to have the little metal bells at the side. It sometimes didn't. So exactly. it would have looked in like the modern day Bowron,
more or less.
So I think let's go to the chase.
But we're talking about the word Bowron was for the old. If you turn the Bowron on the side, you've still got a tray. You can still use it to put the spuds in or bring in something, turf from the stack. But the word Bowron is old, yes. The tambourine came in the 1700s, but popularised in the 1800s. And it became popular in the Rhine, I think, only in the 20th century. And the first sight that anybody had of it in any music, artistic connection in Ireland was with John B. Keane's play Sive in 1959.
1959 is the first physical manifestation. Are we sure of this?
Well, that's the first...
As a musical instrument.
It was commented on. Well, it wasn't. It was only used to accompany singing in the play of Sive.
Yeah, the two travellers come in and they sing in the bar. They predict what's going to happen to Sive.
But the press were fascinated by this. And Sean O'Rady was musical director of the Abbey at the time, and he saw this. He's reputed to have met the fellow who was playing it. And down below the stage, and he said, "What's that?" Your man says, "It's a tambourine." He says, "I could use that." And the following year, when O'Rady was doing music for Brian McMahon's play in the Abbey in the Dublin Theatre Festival, he had Coulter Cool in his ensemble formed, and the tambourine was there, but no jingles. He called it Bowron, and the rest is he had a musical radio program after he popularized it after that.
Let's have a listen. I want to have a listen to people, because again, this is what would mislead you into thinking, well, of course, the Bowron was there. It was there, certainly, it was there at the time of. O'Neill, we might have thought. That, of course, is O'Neill's March, or Marshal O'Neill, featuring the Boron, quite definitely, or the Byron, whichever way we're going to agree to say it with Fintan Valerie this evening. And that, I was asking you, Fintan, as we were listening to that, that recording is from Kiltori Cool and yeah. Sean O'Reilly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, O'Reilly, he had a radio programme, Flacool and Radio, every week. Mm. And he always, the Boron, it always featured him. I remember hearing it myself, being fascinated by it, because we had never heard really, the only drums you heard in Irish music before that were a jazz drum kit in the Keeley bands. And that is really, is only since the 1920s. But percussion didn't feature. So the whole idea of percussion in traditional music is a very new thing. It probably comes out of rock music.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's obviously there were enough people there who wanted to be percussionists.
And in terms of the nature, I mean, we hear the kind of rhythms that it was Paddy Mercier who was playing there, the father of Mel, is the great modern day percussionist in terms of Irish music, for sure. The type of rhythms that were being played then, if it didn't exist, if there was no rhythmic side to Irish music, was it O'Reilly that was giving these kind of rhythms, or was it the players? How did that come about?
There was always a rhythmic side to the music.
The rhythm was very within it, but
complex. Rhythm is within it, and people listening to it, you made your own shapes on it inside your head. But also dancers in more modern time were maybe articulated that with their feet once they had hard floors to dance on.
Yeah,
but people, I mean, people were always. We were kind of enculturated to the idea of drums, really, with modern music forms. I suppose military bands using drums as well.
And in terms of the popularity of the Boron, because, I mean, in recent times, obviously, if we're talking 1959, so essentially we're talking about an instrument that is 60 to 70 years old. Let's go there.
Well, in its modern form, all the modern style of the Boron, the way it's made, the sophistication of the making, and the sophistication of the players, that's all in modern time. So modern, in fact, that most of the players and the people who devised it, they're all still alive and playing and making drums. Mm. So it's quite modern. And that's not to run it down, but it is. I think it's like equivalent to the rise of the guitar in all forms of music. We have the Boron in Irish music. It's on the Irish passport. Most people don't know that.
Yeah.
The Eilean Pipes has got UNESCO status, heritage status. It's not on the passport, but the Boron is.
I want to listen to a little bit of Colm Murphy with Conall O'Gra. This is quite a modern piece.
Well, that's recorded in 2000, but I mean, Colm is one of the earliest of the sophisticated modern players, yes.
Colm Murphy there and Conall O'Gra with that piece featuring a modern day interpretation, for sure, to the year 2000, Fintan Valerie telling us for that recording. I was interested that the launch of the book that you've written this history in, and it's an extensive study right across, huge detail in terms of the historical background, or the lack of historical background in terms of the Boron itself. You launched it in the National Museum for very good reasons. There were no Barons around you.
But the reason for the National Museum is because the only collection of these things which looked like Borons and tambourines and sieves, they have about 60 of these objects. They're all in the National Museum. They've never been in display. When I went to look at them about 12 years ago, your mum says nobody's been in to see these things since 1972. So it's quite amazing. So
and they, none of those are musical instruments. They
yeah,
are.
No, they have yeah. six which are musical instruments, but they're all modern.
Yeah.
There's one of them, it looks the most decrepit looking thing. It looks ancient, but the jingles are pennies. And they're dated 1969. So so they can look old, but you know they have a hard life. Our barons in the 60s, they're always made out of something else, usually an old sand riddle.
Oh, there you go. And I must say, it's a fascinating story. And I'm still amazed that it's 1959, 1960 is what we're talking about for the birth of the baron as we know it today. Fintan Valady speaking to us there about his book, Beating Time, The Story of the Irish Baron. It's published by Cork University Press. Fintan will be appearing at Belfast Strad Festival, which takes place from July the 27th through until August the 3rd. And there'll be a few baron players fighting with him, I would say, that particular event, belfaststrad.com.